It's time for Radio Cals, a weekly program from the Central Arkansas Library System. Every Wednesday from 6 to 6:30 p.m. here on KABF 88.3 FM, we will share with you conversations with interesting Arkansans on primary sources, Chewing the Fat with Rex and Paul, interviews with some of your favorite musical artists on Arkansas Sounds, content from the Butler Center's collections, information about what's happening in the library system, and much, much more. We invite you to let us know what else you want to hear by contacting us at radiocals@cals.org. This program is presented by the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies and the Cals Communications and Public Relations Department. For more information about Radio Cals, including links to resources mentioned in our segments, please visit the Butler Center's blog at butlercenter.org.
Want to know what's happening in the world of Cals? The new programming guide will help you navigate the variety of youth and adult programs, book clubs, movies, and more across Cals' 14 branches, the Ron Robinson Theater, the Butler Center, and River Market Books and Gifts. Look for the programming guide in a branch near you or visit cals.org. February is Library Lovers Month. Show yourself and your local Cals branch some love. With a variety of activities happening all month, there is a book, movie, club, exhibition, or learning experience waiting for you. It's all here. Visit cals.org to view the new programming guide. Hundreds of events and resources at your fingertips. Hello, and welcome to Primary Sources, a featured production of Radio Cals. Here on Primary Sources, we focus on people who are making a difference in Little Rock and Arkansas. Some you might have heard of, and some you haven't heard of, but probably want to know about. Check out cals.org/podcasts for a free podcast of Primary Sources interviews.
Welcome, everyone, once again to Primary Sources, a podcast from the Central Arkansas Library System. I'm Matt DeCampbell, your host. Once again, this time, and we've got another special guest in the studio, Ms. Katu Momolu. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And I got your name correct?
It's Kato.
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 Cut your toe, I always say.
Cut your toe.
See, you'll never forget it now.
No, never now. The last name's much...
The Momolu's good, yeah.
Yeah. So, for those who don't know, just first of all, just tell us a bit about what you do.
I am a fashion designer, and... I guess my claim to fame is I was on season 5 of Project Runway, originally aired on Bravo, and I came in first runner-up 3 times. So that's me, and I've been doing it ever since, you know, just living in this fashion world in Little Rock, Arkansas.
Yeah, and we'll get to how you got here, but let's go back and start at the beginning, because you were born and raised in Liberia.
Yeah.
So tell us both a little bit about the country for those who don't know West Africa very well, and then just kind of what it was like for you growing up there.
Okay. Well, I always say Liberia is right on that perfect little curve of Africa. We're right in the very point, really tiny country. And it was actually founded by slaves from the U.S. decided, you know, that they traced their roots back and wanted to go back home and start, you know, life. And they started our country. A lot of things are very close to, you know, life in the U.S. We grew up kind of very Americanized compared to other African countries. And I think in a way we're kind of hated for it a little bit. But, you know, growing up, it was life. You know, I had my dad, his dad had 9 wives. So I had like 9 grandmothers, and we lived in the city of Monrovia, but we would go back to their village where they lived a lot. And just like the basic concept of just growing up with that extended village. People always hear about the village. Mm-hmm. I literally knew my village that raised me, and it was aunts, uncles, cousins, and basically, you know, my dad was one of the oldest, so he was the one that was kind of chosen to, you know, go to school. Everybody isn't able to go to school. People have this misconception about Africa that, you know, they just don't want to be educated, or they can't, you know, they don't want to go to school. But school isn't free. We don't have public and private. If you don't have the money to pay, your kids can't go. So usually there's one rep that gets to go, and it's usually the oldest. They'll go and they'll come back and teach their brothers and sisters. And when they're able to work and make money, then they bring on more siblings and pay for them. So that was my father. And when we lived in Monrovia, you know, growing up, you know, our cooks, our drivers, everybody that was around us was family. So we were raised by that extended family. And I loved it. You know, that's all I knew for the longest time, until my dad and my mom wanted to extend their education and come to the U.S. So when I was 4, we moved to Boston. And my mom was actually already there in school. So we came with my dad. And I actually remember the very moment I hit the American soil, it was snowing. And I was like, oh my God, what is that white stuff coming out of the sky? It was probably my only memory of that whole trip, coming out of the cab and just seeing this stuff. And I was just mesmerized and scared all at once. And my dad's like, oh, that's snow. I was like, oh, okay. What does that mean? You know, so, and then that just kind of led for my life of going back and forth from there to here.
So then did you end up getting a formal education, or did you get a village education?
I got both. You know, thankfully for me, by the time we were able to go to school, I went to preschool in Liberia, because actually that's my first memories of actually being artistic, like finger painting. I remember just painting and drawing back there. And then I actually started kindergarten here in the States, in Boston. So I got to do both. And then later on in life, we went back home and I got to do 5th grade and 7th grade and a little bit of 8th grade in Liberia. So I was fortunate enough to be able to live both sides and where I could actually remember it.
So was there, and you started to touch on the evolution of your interest
yes.
in art and design, was there really any kind of, was it just kind of a passed on tradition that you learned, or was it, what was there actually arts classes? I mean, how did it work?
I have no idea where my gift comes from, because there's no one in my family that shows it. You know, where I'm from, you don't do art. You do economics, engineering, math, science. Things that, you know, you can get a real job, quote unquote, and make real money. So me popping up as an artist was just looked upon as my family, as, you know, it's just a hobby, you know, you're just doing it for fun. I never knew where it came from, but I know from the very beginning, anything creative was always like joy for me, like finger painting or drawing. And I knew early on when I talked about it at home, the way it was received, it was in a positive way. So I almost kind of knew, okay, if I love this thing, I better keep it to myself, because it might get shut down real quick. So I used to actually go to school and win like art contests. And I remember there was one contest where each class got to do a design, and the design would be created into a pin, and the pin would represent us every time we went on a field trip or something. So by your pin, they would know what class, what homeroom. And I just remember when that was announced, I got all my pencils together, and I mean, I went in on that drawing and I won. So my parents to this day probably don't even know, like, my pin was chosen to represent like the entire first grade class in this preschool. But I don't know where it comes from. I wish I knew other artists in my family. And probably now, if I was to go back home and talk to my uncles and my aunts, somebody might actually say, yeah, I used to love to do this, but I'm like the black sheep. I just popped out of the sky.
So then what's it like otherwise when you're not in school to be a kid growing up in this? And were you at all an outsider because you were dedicating so much of your time to a pursuit that not a lot of people did?
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of nerdy. I don't remember having a whole bunch of friends in elementary school. I was really quiet, like I never spoke. And it was during a time where, you know, being from Africa wasn't cool. You know, it was like the millions of questions. Did you guys come here on the boat? And, you know, do you have monkeys and elephants? And every day it was like these dumb questions I had to answer. And in my head, they were dumb, because I'm like, why don't you know this? Like, why don't you know what we do there? Like, yeah, some people do live in the village, but the animals I always saw were in zoos, just like everybody else. And we had a house. So every day I'd have to bring pictures and be like, this is my house. These are our cars. You know, this is the food we eat. And just, I felt like I was like this specimen. So at some point I just kind of shut down and just never spoke. And I love to read. So, I mean, I actually got deep into like books. I would get these books. They were called Weekly Reader. It was like Reader program. And I'd get these books in the mail. And I was like,
I got
oh my
those
God.
Too. Fantastic.
I got books in the mail. I got my own mail. And they would come. And I would just get them and get in the corner at home. And I was just into my books. And I just got into that world of creativity, just losing myself and just, you know, I didn't care what anybody else was doing. I was more interested in what was coming on the next page. So that kind of took me through the high school. And even in high school, like, I have friends from high school, like, where did this come from? Like, I was kind of thinking about it the whole time when I was reading.
So then, of course, there's the turmoil in Liberia. And were you there, or were you in the U.S. when that started?
We were actually in Canada. So If I back up a little bit, during those times, we went back and forth a lot. My dad had, you know, got a really great job in Liberia. He worked in the government, and we were able to actually move around a little bit more. We lived in North Carolina not too long after Boston, and then at some point we moved back. He got a really great job, kind of like second or third in command, and he just wanted us to come home and live there and go to school. And we were there for fifth grade, like I said, didn't do sixth grade, but then came back for seventh and eighth. And in the middle of eighth grade, there was a teacher strike. And the teachers kind of went on strike, and it was like 1 month, became 2 months. And when it was going on three, I remember being at school, and one of the kids were like, we just saw some boarding school applications that you're going to boarding school in Europe. And I was like, whatever. So I go home and confirm that, you know, my parents were thinking of sending us away to school because, you know, obviously we couldn't just stay and just be out of school indefinitely. So they chose Canada because my dad was really good friends with the Canadian ambassador to Liberia. Oh, so we went there to this all-girls boarding school in Whitby, Ontario, Canada, called Trafalgar Castle. And I was in my 11th grade year when the war broke out. I remember I woke up, went to biology class, and my biology teacher, he was really up on, you know, a lot of things. And he said, there's something going on in your country. I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, there's like a war or something, like a coup. And as soon as he said coup, my heart just sank because I knew what that meant.
Right.
You know, being that my dad worked in the government, it usually means the government officials are going to be murdered. They usually take them and secure all of them and kill them by firing squads so that none of them can get back together and retake over the government that just retook over that government. So immediately ran to the phone, couldn't get anybody on the phone. And I remember I called the ambassador, our guardian, and he just said, you know, I haven't talked to them. I'm sure they're going to be fine. And I remember probably like a few days later that Sunday, my parents called, and both my sister and I were in boarding school there. And talk to us, and we're not really an affectionate family, African families. You know, you don't really hear, I love you, and hugs and kisses. They show you their love, they don't tell you. So that was the very first conversation. I actually remember both my parents said they love me, and in my head, I was like, great, they're gonna die, because why would they say that?
If
they
I never hear that, yeah.
They never say that, so it's like they just wanted me to know, because they really felt like they weren't gonna make it out. So it was rough. I mean, for like 2 weeks, we didn't hear anything, and then my mom, and my brother, my youngest brother who was with her, came. And it was weird because he was a U.S. citizen, but they wanted to separate him from my mother. So she said, you know, we're going to die. We're just going to die together. I can't send my child on a plane, and I don't know where he's going. So and then a few days later, my dad went to work and acted like everything was fine. And when he left work, he just kept driving and driving until he couldn't drive anymore. And he walked to a neighboring country of Guinea, and he was able to get like asylum there, because there was a newspaper article that Charles Taylor, the guy that was trying to take over the government, had said that if he found him, he was personally going to kill him with his own two hands. So with that, he was able to get political asylum and come to Canada. So it was rough. I mean, it was like living in Liberia, because your family's there. Every day you're hearing about family, friends that are being murdered. You know, your childhood memories are being exploded, and you don't know when you're going to be able to go back home or see these people again or talk to them again. So it was rough. You know, I was already really super quiet, and I was just getting out of my shell, and that just took me like right back to square one.
So now you're in Canada, and you no longer are wondering what snow is, I'm guessing.
Right. Oh, yeah. Snow's like an everyday word up there.
So with all the tumult going on and all the tragedy that you were close to, not as close as you could have been, thankfully, but did that push you deeper and deeper into art as an outlet?
It did. You know, I got closer to my art. It was my last year of boarding school, and I remember we lost everything. You know, all we had were just material things, but we couldn't trade them for, you know, what we needed, which was money. So we had to go on, you know, welfare and just get assistance and apply for refugee status in Canada. But because we're refugees, we couldn't apply for any kind of student loans or anything. So that last year, the boarding school actually gave me a I guess, a monetary gift so I could finish. You know, I've been there all those years. So they allowed me to finish with a scholarship. And that was the year that I had an art teacher that worked at the school, and she saw me changing from just drawing things to drawing like clothing and like fashion things. And she said, I think you're going into fashion design. So she kind of helped me put a portfolio together and apply to one of the top design schools in Canada. And it was great. I mean, I got in, and I remember that summer they called my house to say that I got in the school, and I was all, you know, screaming all over the place. And for that one moment, I forgot like everything that was going on back home and all the bad stuff. It was finally some good news. And like an hour later, I calmed down. My parents called me to their room, and they're like, we can't afford to send you to college. You know, we know you got in and you're excited, but you and your sister are going to have to, once we can work and help, you know, support your younger siblings until we can, you know, afford to get you back into school. And I just remember just going to my room, and I bawled like a baby, because I was like, finally, I get to do this thing, and I can't do it now, you know? So it just went back from like happiness right back to depression. And I just remember, you know, I used to draw a lot. I had my sketchbook, and that was like my way to escape things. I'd get my sketchbook and just draw and keep drawing. And one day, my mom found my sketchbook. And she came to me and she goes, I had no idea you were this talented. Like, I know, you know, I've seen you talk about, you know, drawing and art, but I had no idea the level in which you were talented. And I'm sorry we never, you know, supported you in it. But now that, you know, I have a chance to make a second chance of it, I'm going to do whatever I can to make sure that your dream comes true. You're going to go to design school. And at that time, I had shut down. I was like, whatever, it's not going to happen. So I went into my little depression, and woe is me. And she took my sketchbook to everybody that she could think of, like people she volunteered with. And there was a one time she took it to church. It was a lady there who just happened to go to our church who used to be a design instructor in Montreal. And she saw my sketchbook, and she told my mom, your daughter's extremely talented. And I think, you know, pushing her to go to school is awesome. But I think if you wait until you're able to, it might be too late. She needs to go now. So I will pay for her to go to design school.
Wow.
And this stranger just blessed my life, you know. And she came home and she told me, and she made me come to church the next week to meet this lady and talk to her. And she just took me under her wing. You know, she took me to Montreal and showed me the design schools there, took me fabric shopping, got the supplies I needed. And that was the beginning. You know, I started, I found a smaller school in Ottawa, the city where we lived. Couldn't afford to go to Ryerson, which is where I got in. But, you know, the chances of there being one in the little city that we were in was just huge to me. And I was like, well, I'm just going to make the best of it and see what happens.
So to back up just a little bit, do you remember, was there a flashpoint or a specific memory where you switched over from just drawing and art and starting to draw clothes and then kind of design clothes?
Mm-hmm. I actually do. I used to be a huge magazine buff. I don't buy them anymore, but I had these magazines, and I was looking through the magazine, and there was like this picture of this, it almost looked like really South American garment. And it was, instead of like a picture of an actual dress, it was like a drawing of it. It was painted. And it was, every week we had to turn in like 10 sketches to our art teacher of just whatever affected our lives. It could be anything. I remember thinking, I want to replicate this drawing. So I started doing that, and then it went from me looking for other pictures that would inspire me, and I would put my own twist on it. And that's when she started saying, okay, your sketches are like all fashion now. They're not even like landscaping or anything anymore. So, and that was in probably the 10th grade when that kind of started. And then in 11th grade, I actually started making things. You know, being in the all-girls boarding school, you wear uniforms. They're all like mannequins and robots all day. So after you get out of school, like immediately as soon as that bell rings, everybody's like into the individual selves. They become like, I want to wear my sweatshirt to show I'm a rocker. You know, the nerds over there, and they're doing their thing. And then everybody's just doing their own thing. So I remember boxer shorts were like really huge back then. They used to have like the happy faces on them, and Don't Worry, Be Happy was huge. And I used to make like these boxer shorts, because that's what we wore. I don't know why, as girls, we wanted to wear boxer shorts, you know, to be comfortable. But I would paint on them and find different methods of creating like visual art and wearable art. And people would ask me, where'd you get that? I was like, I made it. So I started like making things for people, and even like sneakers. I get like plain sneakers, and I would draw on them, and people would get, you know, buy their own. I wouldn't charge, but I would just do it for fun. And that just became me, and that was like my thing. And coincidentally, I also loved to dance. So I was like the go-to girl for choreography every time there was like a play or anything. So between those two, it kind of kept me busy for a while.
Did you, I mean, you said for plays and stuff, if you were dabbling in the theatrical department, did you ever get into any design there? Any like set design?
I actually did. I was the costume designer slash choreographer.
Oh, of course, the costume designer.
So I actually came up with, you know, whatever costumes were needed. I remember I did West Side Story, and then what other play did I do? There were so many Shakespeare plays, but I was always like the, you know, the go-to girl. So that was kind of cool to just... They saw something in me, and through seeing it in me, they encouraged me and, you know, doing things like that, not actually being in the play, but, you know, being around it, and that kind of gave me the love and appreciation for what goes on behind the scenes, which will later help me, you know, for my fashion shows, because a lot of that stuff kind of helped put it
together.
Yeah,
it's a little theatrical. I mean, you're putting on a show.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, so you're in school in Ottawa, and you're... mentor or benefactor, I guess, you know, has helped you pick out pieces of fabric and all these pieces that you need. Was this kind of a step up, or was this kind of stuff you'd done before? Or was this a whole new level of designing things?
It was a whole new level, because now to get into that school, I have to back up a little bit more. My aunt, who just happens to be the wife of the ambassador who were our guardians, she could sew really well. So she kind of helped me. She gave me like a crash course in sewing, and it didn't help me at all, because once I started school, I realized that I sucked at sewing. I could not sew to save my life. I could draw really great. Pattern making was touch and go, because it involved a lot of math. But the sewing part was just horrible. Like, I would make things in school, and then they would always get ripped up. Like, it was like an ongoing joke, just make, because we made things for ourselves, not other people. So it was always an ongoing joke, like, make sure you're wearing your good panties tomorrow, because, you know, your stuff's going to get, you know, ripped up. So it was tough. It was tough. I mean, there was one day my professor did say, you might want to consider something else, you know, because you're not getting it. And in my head, I was like, how dare you tell me I can't do this? So it pushed me. It really did push me. And I knew I had it, but I was like, why can't I get this one part that's really needed to actually be a designer? So upon graduating, it was like a 2-year course. We did, at the end of the year, there's like a big competition with all the designers, and they pick like designer of the year, and they bring like all these people from, you know, Toronto and Montreal to judge. And I remember I placed top three, you know, I was like third place or something like that. And even though I was third, and most people look at that as last, but with the designer group of like 30, and being the bottom of the bottom barrel, and when it came to sewing, for me to get picked, I wanted to know like why they picked me. And then it was about, you know, really design. It was about, you know, what they saw on stage, it felt was wearable, was saleable, and they felt like it was something they would see in the designer world. And that was the push to just push me even further to really learn how to sew. So once I graduated, I just started working at a fabric store and working at one of the top boutiques there. And I would just look in the clothes and see how I was made, go to my second job at the fabric store, get patterns. And I kind of pre-taught myself how to just do it and fill in the gaps from what I learned and what I didn't know. And it was really practice. It was trial and error. But it was practice, but I was just determined, because I felt like that was God. That third place was just God saying, don't give up. You're going to get there. Everybody has to start somewhere. You have the foundation. Just go. So that pushed me, and I worked and worked. And finally, I felt confident enough to actually, you know, have my own show. Mm-hmm. And that's what I worked towards. You know, I did little shows here and there, and I was in a dance group. I used to make our costumes as well. And, you know, friends that I would just beg, let me just make it for you. Let me make it. I know it might fall apart before you get there, but just let me make it for you. So all those people really contributed to that final time where I actually could just do my own show.
So then is that kind of what propelled you eventually back stateside, or what got you back to the U.S. specifically?
This young man I met.
Oh, well, everyone follows someone at some point in their life, right?
Well, you know, living in Ottawa, it was a shortage of men. I don't know why, but so a lot of the girls and I were we got some information that there was this army base 2 hours away in Fort Drum, New York. Secret information. And actually, my cousins that went down there and had a great weekend and came back, they're like, oh my God, you wouldn't believe it. You can just go down there. You can pick anybody you want. And I was like, yeah, right. So it was like the land of milk and honey. And so needless to say, I had to go find out for myself.
This magical, mystical legend.
Full of men who were just like dying to just stand in the line and say, you're the one. Right. So went down there. I mean, we were there for quite a while, you know, dated some guys and had fun. And one day I happened to be in the mall and this guy walked in and a friend of mine knew him. And she's like, oh, look at, you know, so-and-so. And I looked and I was like, oh, he's cute. That's a cute smile. And that was it, you know. And a week later, she arranged for us to have a date. And 20 years later, here I am. You know, he got out of the Army and he moved back to Arkansas. So we did that long distance thing for like a year. And you have to imagine, it was before texting, FaceTime, and anything close to being free and entertaining. So after $1,000 phone bills, tons of letters, and just riding the Greyhound back and forth, I was like, okay, somebody has to move. Like, so if it's not going to be you, I'll come down there and check things out. And when I came here, I was like, how about Atlanta? Because at the time I was in Atlanta going to design school, I decided to go back to school at this point. So I'm like, I'm going to go back to school and see what's new that I've missed. And that ended up being like a waste of time because I had to start back from scratch because it wouldn't take any credits for me from Canada. So yeah. After teaching the class myself, what it felt like at the time, I felt like that's what I was doing all the time, helping other people. I was like, I don't need to be here. I came here for Christmas to Little Rock, and I just never went back. They're probably wondering what happened to me.
And well, and you, I, when you first came here, it was kind of before the city redeveloped,
before anything,
right?
Yeah. So I was just like, okay, God, what now? I had these conversations with God. I was like, okay, what have I done? You know, I felt like I was being punished a little bit. But I was like, I don't know if I can make it here. I don't think I can do what I want to do here, you know. And at the time, you know, the River Market was way different. Yeah. They had a lot of boutiques, a lot of art galleries. Art galleries have always been really huge here, but it was never fashion. And I just remember thinking, I'm going to have to give up something I really love to be with this guy. And I pray it's worth it. But it worked because he gave me this lecture one day. He's like, you know what? Sometimes when the path isn't already laid out for you, you have to lay it out for yourself. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to create that path if you want it, if you want it bad enough. But this is where I want to be. I want to live here, and I want you to live here with me. So I was like, okay. I almost kind of did it.
That was a portion of an interview with Cut Toe Mamalu, a Little Rock-based fashion designer and former contestant on Bravo TV's hit show Project Runway. To hear this and other Primary Sources interviews in their entirety, log on to cals.org/podcasts.
Radio Cals is a production of the Central Arkansas Library System and its Arkansas History Department, the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies. For more information, please visit cals.org and butlercenter.org. Our producer is Glenn Whaley, and our production manager is Brett Ratliff. Voices by Jasmine Jobe and John Miller. Engineering and editing by Brett Ratliff, Michael Stotts, and Anna Lancaster. Our executive producers are Leanne Blackwell-Hoskin and David Strickland. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next Wednesday at 6 p.m. here on KABF 88.3 Little Rock.